Base Tennis Podcast. I'm Steve Smith along with Alec Tirsic, episode 170. We're going to talk about a field trip. About 10 days ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where we went to the Charlottesville Challenger for a day. But before we go to that, just a quick note on fundraising. We are looking to have people donate money to the Great Bays Tennis, not the podcast, the Great Bays Tennis Education. It is a nonprofit. We have several people that have donated $10 on a monthly basis. And we're just trying to raise a little money so we can do a little better job giving out free educational content. That's our commercial. We need to improve our commercial. Don't you think, Coach?
A little bit.
Marketing 101. Do I get an A plus or an F minus? With another reminder is that we, for over 15 years, have put something on Facebook. So a daily Facebook post. I tell the juniors we work with, they don't want to really be on social media. They want to lose a lot of time with just that, pushing their fingertips instead of hitting tennis balls. But I tell the juniors that we work with, if they don't look at it, this is certainly the older juniors, the parents can, or the younger kids, maybe just do it on the weekends. But if someone doesn't look at our Facebook post, I tell them that they're part-time in a program. It just takes a matter of minutes. The women's final, I was asked to repeat this, the WTA final. Go Buffalo, go Buffalo. Jessica Pegula, on the scoreboard, it didn't look too good, but she got all the way to the finals. She beat Goff by almost the same score in the semis that she lost to Iga Swiatek. But what I was asked to mention is the theme of Swiatek's mental toughness coach. Low expectations, high standards. So if the juniors would write that down. What comes to your mind when you hear low expectations, high standards?
You
stuck?
Yeah,
a little bit. No problem. Low expectations. It's not about the win. It's about competing. You're not expecting results.
Okay.
But the high standards is the work ethic. Here's another one that's along the same lines. Expect nothing, appreciate everything. Those young juniors, perhaps some parents are playing this podcast while they're driving back and forth to tennis. Yeah, expect nothing, appreciate everything. Peter Berwash, you come in the world with nothing, you leave with nothing. Appreciate everything in between. Before we get to the field trip, I want to play this. I had a couple people send this to me. It's from another podcast. I understand there's more than 2.5 million podcasts. There's a few podcasts. Everybody and their brother has a podcast. This podcast is Topspin Tennis, and speaking is the tennis coach, Chuck Tomlin. I think Chuck has made comments on our Facebook page, but if you just listen to this for a second, it's just a sentence or two. Technology.
Clear that the idea was to simplify it for beginners. But somehow, Vic Braden and some of the people who came along tried to continue to push that for people who are advancing players. And so they continued to have players, you know, sort of like, okay, let's buy, even if you buy in and you give into the idea that maybe it was a good beginner idea, where do you change? Where do you make the transition? Well, Vic Braden sort of had, you know, some of his strength. I mean, I love what Vic did for the game, growing the game. Wonderful guy, high energy, you know. I'm not trying to spoil his legacy. I knew Vic also. We talked about a few things. In fact, I even talked to him about changing a few things. I suggested to him that he didn't want to be his legacy, you know, hitting linear through five balls down the target line. I said, come on, Vic, you know, you don't want that to be your legacy, you know. And yeah. He goes, well, you know.
Okay. Speaking Chuck Tomlin, congruent tennis. Let's go back to my geometry class, but not from a math standpoint, but harmonious, together, in agreement. What comes to your mind in hearing that? We could always play it a second time. Where simplifying tennis for beginners. Vic's legacy, not hitting linear through five balls down the line.
Saying that there's more to working on basics and getting better at doing those basics than just hitting the five balls, doing the five ball drill from the forehand or the backhand position, making it sound like that the game is way more complex than that when really it is the basics and the fundamentals that one must conquer in order to get better.
On my phone is a picture of the speaker, Chuck, and he looks like he's a little older. I'm sure, like me, he has some experience. So you don't want to just take one sentence. But what I would say for myself, I spent decades with Vic Braden, most misinterpreted guy. And I think of Dennis Vandermeer, you know, there's an art to simplifying it for beginners. I like the line, simplification is sophistication. But with Vic, you know, the conversation, who knows if it was an elevator ride, if it was a minute at a conference. But what Vic would say, if someone wanted to oppose what he was teaching, is just put forth the scientific rationale. Mm-hmm. What is the reasoning? I think tennis vocabulary, well, the game was linear and now it's more angular. I understand where people are coming from, because it was shake hands at the back fence on your unit turn, the backswing, shake hands at the front, racket on edge throughout the swing, penny on edge. Vic was a mythbuster back in the mid-70s. His book came out in 77, but before that, being on PBS when there's three TV stations, and the fourth TV station matches in the summertime here in the US were on Monday night finals. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look that up. I think it was even before Monday Night Football. But Vic, he was doing the 1 minute tennis tips, mm-hmm. because there was when the players would have their timeout switching sides on odd games. And that's when Vic really came into everyone's living room. So there was, you know, Vic, the person, Vic, the resource, you know, like Vic, for example, grip on three, one, two, three for right hander going to the right for the forehand, grip on two for the serve, grip on one for the backhand, you know, and being on TV and getting information out to the masses, Vic, the backhand, for example, it was the right side of one, no such thing as a perfect grip, just a grip, the least amount of adjustment. Vic would say, I don't care if you shoot it out of your armpit. I don't care how you hit the ball, but how's the racket face at the impact point? But, you know, very few people had the opportunity to work with Vic, the person. But we thought, let me just play this one more time. I mean, it's just a minute and 13 seconds.
Clear that the idea was to simplify it for beginners. But somehow, Vic Braden and some of the people who came along tried to continue to push that for people who are advancing players. And so they continued to have players, you know, sort of like, okay, let's buy, even if you buy in and you give into the idea that maybe it was a good beginner idea, where do you change? Where do you make the transition? Well, Vic Braden sort of had, you know, some of his strength. I mean, I love what Vic did for the game, growing the game, wonderful guy, high energy, you know, I'm not trying to spoil his legacy. I knew Vic also. We talked about a few things. In fact, I even talked to him about changing a few things. I suggested to him that he didn't want to be his legacy, you know, hitting linear through five balls down the target line. I said, come on, Vic, you know, you don't want that to be your legacy, you know. And yeah. He goes, well, you know.
Five balls.
Down the line.
Your legacy, hitting linear through five balls down the target line. I know tennis coaches will line up three balls. They talk about the hitting zone. Vic, you know, the moment of truth, you know, how do you have that racket line at the impact? You know, the ball's on the strings 3 to 6 milliseconds, the racket facing out towards the target. I do think that Braden was very, very misinterpreted with, I know we're going to talk about watching tennis. person who comes to mind, Dan Evans. You know, I love to watch people play all court tennis. Vic Braden's philosophy, Dan Evans is a player, you know, he's fun to watch, baby fed, or you just can honor a Vic Braden philosophy, play all the shots from all positions, any surface, singles and doubles. You know, he had one also too, it was, I believe it was, play better sooner, have more fun faster. Mm-hmm. Another one was, it's not philosophy, it's physics, but with, yeah, if anybody were to challenge Vic, it would be, okay, just provide the scientific rationale. With, before we start talking about watching tennis, being a challenger, or even the, you know, tennis on TV, I think you have to be your own best critic. And you know, I would say, okay, gee, I'm being too idealistic that I would like to see everyone play all court tennis, or too much of a purist, traditionalist, don't want to see people playing serve and volley doubles. But certainly I do appreciate technique. And if someone was going to be a guardian of the game, and you watch pro players, who's going to be the best example to watch? And that's where this kid Alcaraz is just great, great, great for the game. Mm-hmm. Rybakina, she has unbelievable technique overall. It's great stuff. But you know, to me, the better the player, the simpler the strokes.
Right.
You know, and then you know, I think Roger Federer, I'm going to go back to basics, and then in all sports. But I'm certainly not challenging Chuck Tomlin. It's just one comment that was sent from a podcast from people that study our content. You know, we're not really on the side. I think people would think we are on the hero worship of Vic Braden. Uncle Vic, like, such a nice guy. I mean, who could not love Vic Braden? But with, you know, that's how Braden taught the people work for him, is see both sides.
Right.
Take the other person's perspective and try to digest that. With why I said Pegula, coming back to Buffalo, New York, upstate New York girl. But Swiatek, write that down, juniors. Low expectations, high standards. Expect nothing, appreciate everything. In watching tennis, a group of us went to the Challenger in Knoxville, ADK. Mm-hmm. First of all, the players playing that, certainly comes to my mind. I appreciate them, appreciate the players being out there at the Futures and Challenger level, opposed to, this comes back to being idealistic or a purist, tradition, is instead of dropping the tennis racket and picking up the pickleball racket. I think we'll have to have an entire podcast on pickleball. One thing I've already said many, many times is with pickleball, what we need to do is teach people that are playing pickleball to learn how to play tennis. It's one and the same.
Right.
Oh, there are differences. There's not many differences. Because if you learn to play tennis, you can play pickleball. If you're just out there whacking away playing pickleball, you're not going to learn to play tennis. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I can relate a little bit to that. My summer club I put together on Friday nights, 6 to 8 p.m., like a social drop-in, a pickleball drop-in. And most of the time, the players that come out happen to be tennis players. And a bunch of them have tennis skills that they transfer right back into the pickleball game. And it makes it much more fun, and it's much more... The energy's higher, the level's higher, the movement's faster, and that plastic ball actually travels at a reasonable speed than when you see people without any tennis skill whatsoever trying to move it around, right? So, yeah, I agree. I think we definitely do have to implore people to pick up tennis habits and stay with the tennis technique if they're looking to get better in pickleball and just do more with it.
Pickleball became an official sport in 1969. Racquetball became an official sport in 1969. Now in Florida, they have what's called three-wall racquetball.
Okay.
For the most part, racquetball is an indoor sport. And I would say that's faded away, but throughout Florida, the demographics are people my age that are still whacking away at a racquetball. But Newsweek magazine, and I think this would equate, would transfer to pickleball. Newsweek magazine said it took it was a year and a half versus an hour and a half. I may not be fair, but a year and a half to transfer skills, athletic skills, to learn how to play tennis, and an hour and a half. And I heard someone recently say that pickleball should be a drinking game. It's like cornhole,
yeah, or horseshoe.
But it, like anything, people can take it up a level. So I realize I've seen here at the resort 8 brand new pickleball courts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously, I do think it's a little bit of a problem that there are pickleball players are invading tennis courts, but I've seen some former tennis players playing pickleball. It looks like a great drill for half volleys.
Yeah.
And plus a few other things. So there's positives to it. But what comes to your mind? Where do you want to start? I do have this down. Sorry to interrupt again. With field trip, going to watch the Charlottesville Challenger, the Billie Jean King Cup. Mm-hmm. That's on TV. What was on TV Monday through Friday this week out of Brookhaven, where Dave Anderson has helped us with the podcast several times. That's a beautiful tennis facility that they had a major, major pickleball event there. It was on TV. It was on a tennis channel.
Yeah, it was
five evenings in a row. But thankfully, the Women's Billie Jean King Federation Cup was on. I know the Canadians were in the finals. You know how they did today?
Day one, yeah.
They beat the Czech Republic?
No, they beat the Italians.
Oh, beat the Italians. That's right.
They beat the Italians in the final. It was Layla delivered the final win.
Layla Fernandez.
Yeah.
Here's a funny story.
Fernandez.
I made a video for her sister, Bianca.
Okay.
And it was at a public park in Boynton Beach. That is one of the facilities of FM Tennis, Brandon Flanagan. Mm-hmm. And the woman running the office said, there's a box. Do you know anybody who knows Liliana Fernandez?
Layla.
Layla Fernandez. Layla. Yeah, so it's another senior moment. So I said, yeah, her sister's coming here today. And she said, I have a box for Layla.
Right.
It's so funny. As I handed the box to the sister, I said, this is from a fan, I would guess. And without even, didn't leave my hands. It's just a box. And she goes, oh, I bet it's maple syrup. And it was. It was a Canadian fan that knew that she has a place in Boynton. I think she's been practicing all basically in Miami for the last 2 years. But she spent lots of hours in Boynton Beach. There's a side story for you. The girls won. A girl from the Great Base, Lance Hamilton, is part of the U.S. team. I think she mostly specialized in doubles. But they actually beat the Czechs. Mm-hmm. It was the Canadians, the women, who beat the Italians.
Yeah.
All right. Let's start talking challengers. What do you got? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Like you said, we visited the Jonathan Freed Challenger in Charlottesville, Virginia at the Boar's Head Resort. That's also the location of the Virginia University tennis team. That's where the tennis team plays. Spent a day there, checked out the outdoor facilities, checked out the indoor facilities. The Challenger was indoor, even though the day was nice and the weather was great, but they had it indoors. The outdoor courts were empty. Just a nice scenery, beautiful setting, big scoreboards.
Yeah,
beautiful blue and gray courts. I mean,
the Challenger is either going to be an indoor or outdoor event, but
right.
Yeah, I'm amazed by the facility, the University of Virginia.
Yeah, great, great facility. I mean, just leading up into the building at the sports club, there, walking in and seeing the squash courts up front as you come in, the pro shop. The university clothing store and all the merchandise there, and then seeing the two main courts and then the three lower courts where the practice took place. To me, that was, I don't want to say breathtaking, but special. I've never been to a place like that, and I never actually attended a challenger, my first challenger ever.
Well, college tennis, University of Virginia, powerhouse. I think they've won the NCAA 6 times. On the men's side, they won it last year. I think parents listening, you need to have your children go see a college campus. Mm-hmm. This is a unique setting where the tennis facility is not on campus. But typically, I tell people, these Power Five conferences, the athletic centers are like an Olympic Village.
Yeah.
So to play at that level, go to work. Yeah. Go to work. You know, I just could go through names here quickly, but Christian Harrison, just to see his name in the qualifying. Ryan Harrison's brother, Pat Harrison's son. It's great to see him playing because he's had so many injuries, so much bad luck. But here's a story. I was at the U.S. Open, had the credentials to go anywhere, two nights in a row. Harrison maybe was 14, and he's playing John McEnroe. Mm-hmm. McEnroe has to get the juice. And, you know, like 30 minutes later, McEnroe's on TV, but he's out there playing a match. And I think this is the best match to watch is John McEnroe playing young Christian Harrison. I see Stefan Kozlov. I've been in tennis, started as a volunteer coach, a neophyte back in 73, and that's 50 years. I think Kozlov has been playing tennis 100 years. But it's great to see he's still after it. He's a gamer. He was so good, so young, and he's had some wins. He finds a way to win without weapons, which I think that's a really good thing. Yeah, go ahead. There's so many things we have on our desk. We look like we're important here.
We are. We tracked a few other challengers as well throughout the week. But yeah, just some highlights. I mean, I've seen a handful of pros at the Toronto Open. I've attended the tournament a few times over the last 10 years. Excited to see Michael Moe. He was the first seed at the Challenger in Charlottesville. Excited to see Benoit Paire. He was a third seed. Some of the bigger names, Riley Opelka was on the premises. Tennis Sangren, big fan. Looking then further down, Dennis Kudla, another player that I've been following for some time. Alex Mickelson, second seed. So a decent draw all in all. I mean, some known faces, some upcoming faces. And we were there for some of the first and second round matches. So got to see a bunch of singles and doubles.
I asked Steve Campbell, the tennis director, a longtime friend. He was part of the tennis tech program way back when, the program we had for tennis teachers. He, like myself, he worked for Vic Braden. I asked him, I said, hey, why don't you pull up an old challenger? This is a draw from June 12th, 2000.
Mm-hmm. What challenge is that?
It was in Denver.
Denver.
There's some names here. The top seed, Cecil Mamet. He was a guy who could really grind from the baseline. I believe he was a sparring partner for Sharapova for a while. Trace Fielding, DCU. He was at the Roddick Tennis Academy when I was helping with the coaches there. James Blake, the name I think is... went the furthest of all the names I just went through this earlier. Got to be four in the world. Won his first match, but then he lost to Michael Joyce. Michael Joyce was working with USTA. He was coaching Ashton Kruger, who was part of the Great Base under Dave Anderson for many years. Dave told me he recently visited Brookhaven with Ashlyn. But he beat, Joyce beat James Blake. Jeff Salzenstein. Jeff went to Stanford, and he's an internet guru. Some people think we are internet gurus as well. Whatever. But Jeff has said about, I've had this sent to me. He said, what we do, it doesn't look like pro tennis. One thing with Jeff, he played Wimbledon with Chad Clark. One of our students, he probably doesn't know that. He doesn't know that Chad Clark was part of our program. One of our students started him out. Dave Anderson is the one who spent the most time with him. And then also Joey Johnson coached Jeff at one time, mm-hmm. who's been on our podcast. Yeah, just going through this, Kevin Kim, he was coached by Jimmy Johnson, who went to Tennis Tech. And Jimmy took him to Pete Sampras' place, his home in South Southern Cal. They knock on the door, and Pete's wife, like everybody in tennis, is hoping for her to pull through. She's struggling with cancer. But anyway, she opens the door, a beautiful woman, and she said, "Oh, I'll go get Pete. Come on in." And Kevin Kim looked at Jimmy and said, "I'm going to start working on my surf." But just to go back and look at these names, it's really interesting. And then I think also, like, what are people doing today? But I think when you think of a James Blake becoming number four in the world, I don't think juniors think of him, being in a challenger. It's not an ATP event, a step below, but great, great players. Mm-hmm. But, losing in the second round. Go ahead. What else you got?
Spent that day there, watched a bunch of matches in the morning. We were there almost all day. And then just wandered around the facility a little bit, took a look at some of the other things that they got going on. They had some kids programs and some of the other courts, some adult programs. Also the basketball gym was open. We went down there as a group and we played some basketball. It was a few players in there. Just some of the names by looking at the draw list that were in the basketball court with us was Bernard Tomic was down there playing some basketball. I want to see who else here, if I know any of these names or if I recognize them by name. No, I mean, there was a few players. I might not know them. I can't put the name and the face together, but I know Tomic was down there, watched him rally and practice a little bit down on the practice courts with a few players. Also, watched Ethan Quinn. He was also practicing down below. I'm thinking who else is on this list. Alex Mickelson, he was practicing as well. So, kind of some preparation before their matches and just speaking with their coaches and going over some practice drills and tactics and whatnot. It's been very nice to see. High-level tennis up close is always good. We were literally feet away from some of these upcoming stars.
Well, for sure. Then we followed where the players went the next week and how they did. With Alex Mickelson, I know Ivan Osoretsu works with us. He lost in the first round.
Yeah.
The first week. Who did he lose to?
He lost to Cannon Kingsley. He lost two sets, 7-5, 6-3.
Yeah, so let me say this about brain typing. Alex, listeners, he's not an E, he's a capital E. I tease him and say he would talk to a tree. I would have been labeled actually by someone who knew it quite well as an introverted extrovert. It's really where you get your energy from. What I tell young coaches I work with, and I've certainly been called every name under the sun, but very proud that Vic Braden called me the observer's observer. Okay. What I learned from Vandermeer at a very early age is I can learn a lot of names very quickly. And one time, it was traveling with Braden, and Vic said, "Hey, Steve, why don't you introduce everybody?" And I had just been in the corner talking to one person. That's not what an extrovert does. An extrovert like yourself, they work the room and they talk to everybody. So I had not learned all the names, which I can do fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. But the observer's observer, to watch people, what I tell, and I was watching you, I put myself in position, okay, where can I see the most? And I put myself in a position where I could watch the matches and the practice. I was disappointed I didn't get to see Alex Mickelson play, but Ivan knows him. He wrote some things down for you. What do you say about him? This kid wins the next week. Tell us how it worked out. He lost in Charlottesville, but he won the tournament in Knoxville.
That's right, yeah. He lost in the first round
there. So I asked Ivan, does he have the it thing? So Ivan, whose sister plays Division I college tennis, and I believe exactly the same age, sister and Alex Mickelson. He says most definitely he has the it thing. What does that mean? He's chilled, calm, cool, collected, composure.
Yeah.
I mean, so many young kids today, and I think that has a lot to do with, every match they play is you know, it ends up on the internet. People can just push buttons and say, how's this kid doing? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's healthy.
Yeah, I mean, we got a few notes. Yvonne took the time to just chime in a little bit on Alex and kind of what, you know, some of the things he knows a little bit about him. Mom Sandra, also a tennis player herself. She played for San Diego State. Yvonne's had the opportunity playing with her and just rallying. It says, you know, even Alex quotes, it's just human backboard, never misses. Every ball comes back on a dime, just pop, 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 right there. And, you know, even Alex quoted it, she makes every ball, just doesn't miss. Dad Eric, he's a 3-time All-American. He attended University of Redlands. Yeah, like you said, has the it thing. He yawns between points. What else have we got here? We played high school tennis at Aliso Miguel High School, same school Ivan. Yvonne attended. He committed to Georgia before going pro. He, with this win in Knoxville, put him in the top 100. So he cracked the top 100.
So if you get below, at 104 or below, depending on what date, and I think early November, that would put him straight into the Australian Open.
Yeah, I mean, he was looking back on seeded players from the Charlottesville Challenger. His rank was at 112. And at the end of the Challenger, the bottom there, I think he's just cracked in the top 100 now. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, Alex is a good player. I mean, best result, he played in the finals of Newport 250. He loses to Mannarino 2-4 in the final. However, beats Cressy, last year champ, in the first round in three sets, 6-7. 6-4, 7-5. So he will probably play in the next gen finals.
So he should be, or he could be, scheduled to be a freshman at Georgia.
Yeah.
That wasn't last year. That's this year. It would be this upcoming spring. So it's all happened so fast. Mm-hmm. Now, Bernard Tomic, in the week following Charlottesville, played Mickelson in the first set, and it was 4-6, 7-6, 6-4.
Yeah.
Very first round. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tomic was close. Anything else on Mickelson notes?
Yeah, just a little bit about his game. I mean, great back end, very textbook looking. I took some time to kind of observe him play and you know, watch from behind just to kind of get an idea what his game looks like. Loves to come to the net. He's got great hands at the net, and he's just an all-around fighter. He's a gamer. He just doesn't give up, just keeps going. I mean, when I looked at some of the results at the Newport, I think in the semis he played Isner, beat him in two sets. You know, Isner's throwing down bombs, big serves. Nicholson's a tall guy himself. I believe he's 6'4", 6'5". So, you know, someone to look out for in the next little while. He's only 19, just turned pro. So, yeah, it's fun to watch for sure.
Just looking at the top of this Knoxville Challenger, Michael Moe, seeded one. I know my son Connor has a win over him in the pro, so I think that's where, you know, Connor would look back, go, yeah, maybe he was 14, but you know, he was certainly past juniors. But it's great, you know, it's great to see how these people keep hanging in. Martin Dom, man, he hits a big serve, mm-hmm. and you know, coming on Milan, having some of these players, I've watched them play really since they were 11, 12 years old. With Martin Dom, I would say if you looked at film, the mechanics are the same. Typically, that's true. Mm-hmm. The swing patterns really don't change. But the myelin does, the amount of myelin and the substance the brain produces, coding the neural pathways, its speed and smoothness of movement. Mm-hmm. And even though you know, he's not the most efficient, elegant player, but it looks smoother.
Yeah.
Even though it's the same mechanics. Kudla and Gibson, they played in, and we have comments on that. In Charlottesville, they played again. And I have a lot of respect for Kudla, but it looked like maybe his tennis career, maybe he's coming back from an injury. He just was not at his best in that Charlottesville event. I wonder if he's winding it down. And I've got some notes on like maybe a dozen players that I watched. We'll go through. Kudla's one of those. But after losing convincingly, like 2-1.
He lost 1-3.
One and three.
Yeah, to Gibson, yeah.
Or to Patrick, yeah. And then he came back the next week and beat him with but players, you know, they're just, you know, the few I talked to is that it was, some were saying it was cheaper to get from Charlottesville to Calgary than from Charlottesville to Knoxville.
Yeah.
I was going, I would explain that to me. But here's something of interest for me. Liam Draxel, he won Calgary.
Yeah. He was a wild card entry.
Yeah. I didn't see that.
Yeah. He was a wild card entry.
Years ago, his parents, they had a timeshare at Saddlebrook, Tampa. Brian's a teaching pro, great guy. He's played so many matches at our place with young kids. Great, great competitor, great sportsman. But it's great to see that because Liam Draxel, early on, they did, for many, many years, Liam worked with Casey Curtis. Mm-hmm. But before that, he was working with his dad. And I worked with his dad with Liam via video. Big, big legs, strong. But, you know, he always had a smile on his face when he was a kid. I'm talking, you know, 10, 11 years old, really young, maybe even younger than that. He had a smile on his face, and no matter who he had him play, he was appreciative. And I recently sat with his father while he was playing the NCAAs. That, you know, my comment would have been, gee, he could have forced more, stayed a little closer to the baseline. But yeah, I think the people who love competition,
right?
Win or lose, they love the game, and if they can just hang in there. But I think it is also the war of financial attrition. That's where, thank you for these players to stay with tennis, because a lot of people are saying, hey, I can make more money playing not racquetball, but
pickleball,
wiffle ball. There is baseball, there's softball, and there's wiffle ball.
Right.
And when I grew up, we had a baseball diamond in our backyard across the street. Our neighbors had a rink for outdoor ice. And I was crummy and I couldn't hit a wiffle ball, but some smart guy came along, great guy. And there was a wiffle ball bat that was as big as a watermelon. And then I could hit a wiffle ball. But, I have some notes on some of the players. Why don't you tell us, what about watching Tomic practice?
I've never, you know, just being at the Challenger for the first time and being able to see some of the players up close and being able to see them that from a very short distance, tall guy, just took me off by surprise. On TV, everybody looked a little bit smaller. I mean, came in broad shoulder, 6'5", athletic. I don't know exactly who he was sparring with or who he was practicing with. Came on court. I believe he was with his girlfriend there. Hit some rallies, then started to play some points. And I didn't follow him a whole lot in his earlier days. You know, I read some things about him, you know, some good things, some bad things, some drama, some success. And, you know, overall, you kind of have a picture of somebody in a bad end, in a good way. And just looking at him and how he was playing points and the way he was counting and the way he was carrying himself, I was surprised a little bit. I expected his attitude to be at a higher level, a bit more professional. I felt like with some of the easy rallies that went down and he missed, and some of the body language that I was seeing was I don't know.
I think one positive in watching, you know, there's a positive, negative, negative, positive, is that he was really interested in the score. The coach was feeding the ball in and he was playing, and they did several situational drills, but at one point playing a backhand approach shot, mm-hmm. and they're playing the point out.
Right.
And every time before the coach fed the ball in, they call shagging the ball. I just take one ball and feed it in, and then you just cross your arms and now you're coaching on the tour. Mm-hmm. Julian Krinsky's a funny guy. He was on our podcast. He goes, yeah, pro tennis, coaching on the pro tennis level didn't work for me. And he just crosses his arms and stands there but he was emphatic about the score.
Yeah.
Just denouncing the score.
Called it before every feed.
The positive in that, competitive animal.
Yeah,
he's got the juice.
Yeah, he's got the juice. He's got the spirit, but when losing some of those easy points, or he'd beat himself up, and the energy, the body language would say that that competitiveness, that, that competitive nature just looked a little bit.
Yeah, generally with parents, it's either one or the other. Either the father or the mother is more the tennis force. Mm-hmm. And certainly with Bernard, with his father. But when you mentioned Mickelson's mother, Ivan's note that the mother could put the ball on the dime. Like Ivan Lendl, he was tied to the net post when he was a kid. His mother was number two in the former Czechoslovakia, and she wanted to be number one. Kathy May, Taylor Fritz, you got to figure, well, you know, she was top 10 in the world. That's pretty good to be able to rally with your mother. It gives you some humility. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if you're worried about your ranking, but you go home and your mom can beat you and beat you like the bongos. With Jimmy Connors, it was in his autobiography that he didn't take a set from his mother until he played Kalamazoo, which means 16s. Mm-hmm. And I would guess that Jimmy was good enough to be there a little bit, you know, before turning 16. But mm-hmm. And then the Bryan brothers, they get their mother going. Kathy Blake, I believe, that, you know, she was a very good player. Oh, mom, I could beat you when I was 10. And the mother goes, no, it was 13. But that took place with this young girl, a very good 9-year-old here from New Jersey. And the mother's just started playing some club tennis. Yeah. And the mother said, well, no, I can't even keep up with my 9-year-old daughter. And what a special 9-year-old. Yeah. It's like the perfect child has arrived. But she's, oh, mom, I could beat you before I advanced to yellow balls. I could beat you with green dot balls or whatever.
Green dot balls, yeah.
With George Goldoff, great story. Saw George there. He lost in the doubles in Charlottesville and then in Calgary. But the team that he lost to with his partner, both Charlottesville and Calgary.
Yeah, Calgary.
The team they lost to went on to win. Yeah. 7 years in Tibet. He spent 7 straight months with us during the pandemic. So he has a pretty good handle on what we do. When he's not playing, he's specializing in playing doubles. He's at Brookhaven in Dallas with Dave Anderson. Yeah. Runs a program. I think, you know, he's one of those guys who's going to hang in there, tenacious, and is not going to go away, and he really wants to play. It's a tough battle because of the finances. But he also, I think it's really the story of circumstances that he was coaching at Baylor. And he was at an event, a pro event. And when he was at Baylor, they were in the finals. They runner-up in the NCAA National Championship. So he's at a pro event. He's been a guest on our podcast, and he just borrowed some rackets, and it was a pickup doubles partner, and they won the event. I think it was the Futures, which is, it's a big step up between Futures and Challengers. But seeing George at the tournament reminded me of being at a Challenger in Hawaii, where Salisbury, who's been one in the world, mm-hmm. he's playing with Rahm this week in the ATP Championships.
And Torin.
He played with the Irish player O'Hare. And so generally that's the way it works. There's very few teenage sensations where teenage sensation to me is someone who's playing on TV, like an Alcaraz,
right?
Teenage sensation,
Rune, teenage sensation,
yeah. With Kudla, the I think for the listeners, is UTR is a 14.35, mm-hmm. doubles is a 14.17, highest ranking was 53 in the world, born in 1992, won 4.5 million. This is just off Wikipedia. So how accurate is it? It's got to be pretty close, though. I mean, to win $10,000 playing pro tennis is tough.
Yeah, I mean, the challenger, Mickelson, beating him in the final in Knoxville, that's a 10. You took home 10,000, so.
Yeah, so, but to win 4.5 million, 10,000 is not very much.
No.
It's currently 180, so as is, you know, question G is, he's been injured, some bad luck. But I was told that when he was a young kid, he's from the Ukraine, that they couldn't pull him off the backboard. And when he came up through that famous program, Championship Tennis Center, there's Junior Ori and Mitchell Frank. And I believe all three were top 10 ITF at one time.
Okay.
But Junior Ori, he came to see us for 4 days with his grandfather, and the person brought him was Alex Vukovic, tennis player we trained, played at Princeton. He's been a guest on our podcast. But Junior ended up staying 4 months, and it's all documented how he made all these changes in his game. And then afterwards, he beat Bjorn Frantangelo, had won Junior French, and Junior beat him at Kalamazoo. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe, you know, Bjorn didn't have enough time to get back and acclimatize or whatever, but Junior was interviewed, said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "For the last 4 months, I've been hitting off a cone." I don't think that was good for us, because some people, they don't go very deep in studying what we do. And that's the rep we have. Oh, they just make you hit off a cone. It's so fast. He has, to me, he has the speed of a wide receiver, Junior Ori. If you took all three of them, but the third one, Mitchell Frank. So you took the strokes of Dennis Kudla.
Kudla.
I just think hitting off a backboard. And certainly you could say, well, maybe he doesn't have the biggest weapons, but he's solid. Oh, yeah, maybe the backhand's better than the forehand, that kind of thing. But he's a solid, solid tennis player. Not the biggest guy either. But Mitchell Frank, you know, he did so well in juniors, so well in college, right out of the box as a freshman, he won the All-Americans. But anyway, Kudla one time had the chance to practice with Nadal. And the person asking him questions, interviewing him, said, "You think he's the toughest player mentally in the world?" He said, "No, I think Mitchell Frank is." So he has a pretty good sense of humor. I was his driver one time. It's not that I know Dennis Kudla, but I was at an event with Austin Krajicek, and Austin and I drove up to the qualifier for the wild card, the Australian Open. Mm-hmm. Stevie Johnson won. He just had forgot to sign up for the Australian Open. He was ranking was high enough to get in. So I told Dennis, I said, "You know, watched you play so many times." I said, "The first time I watched you play was at Kalamazoo." And he goes, "I apologize. I was so cocky." I think that's worth saying that because I think too many juniors, the sooner they can find out, you know, be humble versus being cocky. But he was the one that said that. But he did look really flat against Gibson. Let's advance to that with some stats I have on Patrick, but first some notes I have on Patrick. Did you watch much of that?
I didn't. I spent a little bit of time during that time at the practice courts, observing Tomic and Quinn and Mickelson, some of those guys warming up for the matches for after.
Patrick's UTR, 14.5.
Okay.
You know, the juniors that are... You know, I'm going to talk about a player here and direct it towards the UTR. We have so many players that are, say, for example, they're 11 or below.
Okay.
You know, they're 9.99, hoping to be a 10, 10.2, 10.3, hoping to be an 11. But Patrick has had some bad health, bad breaks. Amazing. I think he was ranked number one in every age group. But he's been at it a while. He's 271, best ranking. He's made $200,000, which is a chunk of change.
Mm-hmm.
That's not easy to do in tennis. Family, his father's from Czechoslovakia. Patrick's a big hockey fan. He went to Texas A&M. So if you were to look up Patrick Gibson DNA, athletic DNA, he's 11 years old, and it's a great, great interview. So now I believe he's 24, but now certainly when the season's over and it's winding down, there's a preseason, I could send certainly him an email. I would say that I was a supplemental coach for Patrick. Now we have Patrick on film hitting the ball really well, right-handed and left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how much time he spent with us. And he spent so much time with Matt Clore. One time I was speaking at a PTR function. It rains. Everybody comes inside. And it was Mark Kovacs, who's a leading educator in tennis, and he was going through the serve, and he had Patrick Gibson up on the screen. And he was very, very young, but, you know, he was certainly fortunate to, in many, many ways, maybe not straight across the board, but fortunate that the USTA supported his tennis. He was recognized at a young age as a great prospect. So he beat Kudla, you said 1-3, he lost the next week.
So he plays Kudla, he beats him, then he plays in the next round, he plays Brandon Holt, beats him 1-4. This is all from Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And then he goes into the semifinal and he plays Zukayev, a tall Kazakhstani player, and he plays a tight match. One break in the first set, 6-4, and then loses 7-6 in the second set, 7-4 in the breaker. Zukayev goes on and wins the tournament against Aidan Mayo, 3-4. So, I mean, close match there in the semifinal. Few points away from actually going into the final at 271 rank at the Charlottesville Challenger. So puts up a good fight, but doesn't come through enough to go into the final. So still an impressive run for the week.
Yeah, just more about his story. I mean, he went to Texas A&M in January, went there one semester. I know he thinks very highly of Steve Denton and the Texas A&M program. He's a beast. You know, he's a man. I remember when he was a boy and got out to the Junior Wimbledon semis. Mm-hmm. Again, our fact checker, maybe it was the finals, but he went deep in the draw. And, you know, like maybe 2 weeks, day in and day out before, he was playing with Chris Clore. And at that time, Chris, you know, like his brother, very good athlete. And, you know, he was just breadsticks, maybe not breadsticks and bagels, but breadsticks and breadsticks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, the guy has definitely spent a lot of time in the gym. Big, strong guy. And so he just served so well. He had 13 aces. Now, again, I mentioned I like to watch someone like a Dan Evans. So I could say, well, okay, I be my own best critic. You know, maybe too idealistic. You know, you can win playing any which way, right? Mm-hmm. In the match, though, Patrick, behind first serves, you could argue, well, he won overall. We didn't chart every point, but enough, 85 points. Mm-hmm. And that was just missing, you know, maybe 10 points.
Okay.
But when you chart 85 points and you miss 10, the stats still tell a pretty accurate story. But serving at 56.5 first serves. He won 88% of his first serves. One thing to prove his game, he's got to improve his second serve. I mean, Kudla can return solidly on both sides. He's at 47% on his second serve. That's one of the biggest stats on how do you make it to the next level. Mm. The old adage is, how good are you behind your second serve?
Right.
You're only, Pancho Gonzalez, you're only as good as your second serve.
Yeah.
But he was 100% at the net, but he only came in 7.1%. And now he was dominating. Again, hats off to Kudla. And I think that's a lesson for anybody listening, is that you can lose 1 week, and then the next week, turn it around. Turnaround story for me, two players. Ryan Simmy, blast from the past. Very good tennis player. He's playing Clayton Stanley, kid I coached. First time I ever charted a match on CompuTennis, and Clayton lost convincingly. It was one of the 1-1. It was just people look at it. Clayton, smart guy, but he got 40. He found out he got 40% of the points, and they played, which doesn't happen so much in juniors. They played like the next month, and it was very, very close. Very, very close. It was like, this is a real match. This is, you can go either way. So stats do tell a story. Kudla only as well, identical. He came in 7.1%. And I think that's a brain drain all the way through tennis. You know, you're up. With our study of Jacobson, you know, Carlos Goffi as well. With Bill Jacobson, he took Carlos's Goffi's concept of green light, yellow light, red light points. So when you're ahead or even behind by 2 or 3 points, I told the father of this young 9-year-old girl who plays soccer and basketball, is very athletic, hey, when you have 40 love, you're 9 years old, hit a serve right in the middle of the box and come to the net.
Yeah.
And then, because then you develop some instincts. I think it's a crisis, especially with kids playing one up, one back doubles, with the unforced errors. One up, one back doubles, to finish my thought. Hey, go forward.
Yeah.
How could the Bryan brothers win, seemed like 1,000 tournaments, but the record for winning the most events, and you're watching them play and say, well, we're going to play one up, one back. And it just, and to justify that, go with the best and forget the rest. With unforced errors, though, of 85 points, and this is the opinion, Yvonne is the one who charted it. So it's always the opinion of the charter, was it a forced error, unforced error?
Right.
But 51 points were charted as unforced errors. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to make a mistake, try to make it, coming back to putting all our podcasts together, Paul Wardlaw, in the green zone, the forecourt, what he calls a point ending. And when you're serving like that, when Patrick was just serving bombs, and I think another thing is straight across the board with players, and I know it was just on our last podcast, the Big Three, with Nick Nemeroff. You know, I thought that was great. What's the difference between American tennis and European tennis? It's American players. And please don't say serve plus one. Anybody's listening to this, drop that phrase, especially if you have anything to do with junior tennis. Serve plus one, because people are, as he said, trying to hit a serve and then just rip a forehand. And that shouldn't be happening, especially in the early formative years. Football term, the quarterback, stay in the pocket, neutral defensive area, hit a backhand. It's just so common for players to be running around the backhand. And Patrick, I mean, the underspin backhand is very effective. He's hitting it deep. But one of the reasons he's hitting underspin is that, like so many players, his first impulse is he wants to get a forehand.
Right.
And they start to make a turn for forehand. Their body's already swiveling to the right, turning to the right. And then they realize they can't make the play, and then they have to.
Yeah, they fall back on the underspin back.
They have to do that because, they're fall back. Yeah, they're not necessarily always on their back foot, but they're hitting late. And I think also, too, is that the formative years is first thing you got to do is just get a backhand. One thing on our charting sheet, on the return of serve, it can be a plus-plus, which is a winner.
That's right.
Minus-minus, which is unforced error. It could be such a good serve that the return's minus F. Mm-hmm. These are Jacobson's terms. Is a plus, it's strong. Minus is weak. IP is neutral in play. Okay. There also should be AP. Are they approaching off the return? And that's, you want to try to stay away from the words always and never. You chart someone and say, well, you just simply never even think about coming in behind their second serve. So once again, plus plus on return would be a winner. Minus minus, we're so nice in tennis, is that's an unforced error.
Right.
Plus plus is a winner. Minus minus should really be a loser. I wonder how people would
take that
yeah. If
that got reworded differently.
Yeah, reworded. So thank you. So then it can be, it's a great serve and they got their racket on it. It's a forced error. It could be plus strong, minus weak. IP, they just neutralize, it's just in play. But return should also be an AP, or it's an approach shot. I listened to a podcast the other day with Mark Bay, the USPTA. Mark Bay is a coach based in Chicago, tennis lover, passionate about the game, does some TV work. And he's talking about his college coach at DePaul and how he called ground strokes, ground shots.
Ground
shots. Okay, I heard that. That's great. Ground shots. And we need to just off of that idea called volleys, air shots.
Yeah, that works.
Say, okay.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. You know, you hit one air shot. Maybe that would be better than saying you hit one approach volley, or you hit, you know, you played an entire match and you hit zero overheads. How many air shots did you hit? And my notes with Tomich, somebody who's a wise guy, I've been called a wise guy before. Burnout Tomich story. I hope he can come back. He's still young. 14.3 on the UTR, doubles is 13.35. Highest rank is 17.
Yeah.
Born in 1992, 6.3 million he's made.
Yeah.
Currently with ranking of 291. I heard him say that he thinks he's still one of the best 10 grass court players in the world, and before his day is done, he's going to win Wimbledon. One time he said to a reporter, "I'm just counting my millions." And Andy Roddick said he should count the millions that he's left on the table. Mm-hmm. So he has shot himself in the foot. You know, at one time, also incognito, what I like to do when I go to tournaments is put up the hoodie and not to be rude, not to be shy, but instead of just shaking hands and exchanging pleasantries with people, "Hey, how you doing?" And all the small talk, just like I think tennis matches in general, what takes place on the bleachers is small talk, not fact finding. I one time put myself in a position to listen to Darren Cahill up at the US Open working with Bernard Tomich with the,
I mean, just a touch on Tomich, like his best major placement was when he lost in 2011 to Novak in quarters, right? So I guess if that was his highest place, then maybe that would be the place he'd come back and win a slam at, right? To back up his own story.
I know that the Australian version of 60 Minutes, relationship he has with Leighton Hewitt and Davis Cup, and you know, even one of our former students, Craig Tiley, who's the CEO of Tennis Australia. All you have to do is that's amazing with a computer today. And he's hopefully he can win the Australian public back. And it's just gotten some trouble. And what happens with players, you know, I don't think many of us could even fathom that. Pro athletes now, they don't even go out because, you know, they go out, have a drink and whatever. And next thing you know, all these people taking photos of them.
Yeah.
So it's the one thing we say, you know, under the microscope, and now, you know, everybody's got a camera. It's awful. Cannon Kingsley, I saw him hit one time with one of our juniors down at Lake Nona. Plays at Ohio State. He's a 14.15. Okay. He won the doubles, not in Knoxville, but the next week. Not in Charlottesville, but the next week. I don't know if this is accurate, 432, but he's a young guy, born in 2001. And I believe he's going back to play at Ohio State for his last semester, January. I'd be interested in the NIL, the named image and licensing. Just small talk at the tournament. It's down here that he's won $65,000. Is that, you know, what type of money now is he getting from Ohio State? That's really interesting in college sports, college tennis. I know some programs that they just have the money to give. Mm-hmm. In some other big time schools, the coaches have to raise the money. Yeah. But it would be interesting in the next few years to see, you know, how does that change college sports. Brandon Holt. I know my son Connor practiced one time and said, "Hey, this guy's got great technique." Tracy Austin's son, born in 1998, young guy as well. This is a chunk of change, $385,000. Currently 180. Doubles is only a 12.9, but singles, again, 14.5. I think when, especially when teenage boys hear that, that's a high level player. The highest level player as far as money earned, it was at the challenger was Benoit Paire, UTR 14.67. And I don't think the pros are really even in tune with the UTR. That's maybe another reason why
I don't think they follow it much. No.
Another reason why they're pros.
Yeah.
But he was he wasn't the top seed, or was he the top seed?
No, in Charlottesville, he was third seed. He loses, or he goes into the third round, and he was to play. He plays Ethan Quinn, and he loses to him in two sets, 7-6, 6-2, and then he goes up to Calgary. And he loses in the first round. He doesn't get past the first round. He goes down. He's also seeded. He's a third seed in Calgary. And he loses to Max Kasanowski of Poland. He loses in three sets. So definitely somebody that, you know, I used to watch, and I used to kind of follow when his rank was a bit higher, when he was, you know, televised a bit more. A unique technique. I like his popped collar style, kind of like yours, as he plays. Do want to mention, as I was up at the practice courts and I was hoping to see him come down and warm up for his match, his first round match, didn't see that. Guy just came on court, dead cold, pulled out his racket and said, let's go. So a little bit unusual. I wasn't expecting it, but nonetheless, good player. Like you mentioned, not a lot of guys were coming out to the net. This guy was gunning the net. Whenever he saw an opportunity, he could come up. The opponent was in trouble. He was running up.
I never heard that pop collar. Elvis Presley, the king. I'd like to think that I have it up now because I'm trying to be the king, but all those years teaching in the Florida sun is to get the sun off your neck. He's ranked, his highest rank was 18 in the world, born in 1989. Mm-hmm. But where he's number one in the tournament is dollars earned in the $10 million mark.
Yeah.
Now his forehand, very much like Francis Tiafoe. Come back to Kudla when I think of Francis Tiafoe, is that group of Junior Ore, Mitchell Frank, and Dennis Kudla. Tiafoe is such a class act. You hear him thank those three because they were ahead of him and they were playing all over the world, playing international juniors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, TFO, obviously that was, I mean, I think people need to know the backstory. Like, okay, if that wasn't in place, you know, TFO would be the first one to say that he wouldn't be where he is today. So everything that takes place in those early years. But Peter Burwash, with the late Peter Burwash, used to say, you only know it's a weakness if you apply pressure.
Right.
So when I think of Benoit Paire, I think of TFO's forehands, a few extra moves. Mm-hmm. Not that it's wrong, but there's a few extra moves. And a few moves to calculate, and coming to what we started with this gentleman, Chuck Tomlin, could be simplified.
Could be simplified.
You know, yeah. That would perhaps be in opposition to what he's saying. But it could be simplified, but you have to pressure it. Mm-hmm. Also, too, is that hit the serve of Benoit Paire.
Yeah.
Let me say this about his forehand first. You have to take time and space away.
Right.
You have to, you know, if someone has extra movements on their forehand side and you're just rallying to it, it's like the tennis court's as big as a barn, and can they hit the side of a barn? Mm-hmm. You know, years ago in baseball, the kid can't hit. He couldn't hit the side of a barn. Or a basketball player, they can't get the ball. They can't get the ball in the hoop. If they were in a rowboat in the middle Atlantic, they couldn't put the ball in the ocean. We can't talk to kids that way anymore.
No.
But no, it's true. Even though he wasn't a pure serve and volleyer by any means, is Benoit Paire, and he has, you know, slight palm up, how he turns the racket up, so he can't generate as much racket hit speed. Mm-hmm. But I think people have to understand Milan. It's like, as great as Alcaraz is, and people listen to us, we're not saying, okay, Alcaraz should change his serve. But if you watch Alcaraz, he has what's called a chain puller syndrome. Mm-hmm. That's where you pull the cords to let the bus driver know to stop the bus. So when you pull the cord down, you pull your elbow down and it has to go back up a second time.
Right.
And say, well, you'd have a better serve if he just let the elbow go up once. Mm-hmm. But then you have to say, well, wait a minute. The way Milan works, the athlete being a biocomputer, you got to deprogram, reprogram. I think a better way to say that is you got to unlearn and relearn. And unlearning and relearning is different than learning. Mm-hmm. It's a double whammy.
That's right.
So it's not a simple thing to have someone change their strokes, especially when they're older. So, but with Benoit Paire, though, he definitely, as soon as he had an opportunity, a player is in, according to Braden, 4 weak positions, legs crossed on the backhand side with a racket low, legs crossed on the backhand side with a racket high. Right. And then you just flip it, legs crossed on the forehand, racket low, legs crossed on the forehand with a racket up high. And why to say that is, say it over and over again, and when you teach, have a kid go, you tell a kid, what are the 4 weak positions you're looking for? Mm-hmm. And Vic used to say, once you get a player in that position, they should just hear footsteps. Now, a lot of people don't understand that what Braden did at one time for Kramer's, he ran the Pro Tour. So what a learning curve. He spent so much time watching Lou Hode, Pancho Gonzalez, you know, Rod Laver, mm-hmm. you know, even go back to, you know, Bobby Riggs. And his idol, I already mentioned, maybe Jack Kramer. Riley Opelka. Yeah, I know he's been injured for a long time. His highest ranking has been 17. Young guy, 1997, 4.2 million. I know that Tom Gullickson had a lot to do with getting him started way back when. I think it's in Palm Coast, Florida. Mm-hmm. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say Riley. I mean, he was at the Charlottesville Challenger.
Right.
I saw him. I didn't actually see him play the match against Sangren. I think that match was on at the same time while the George Goldoff match was on, or it might have been on a different day. I'm not too sure.
But first round, he beat Sangren, right?
Yeah, he beat Sangren in the first round. You know, again, close match. Just one break, 6-4, 7-5, and then he withdrew the next round. And he was down there with his camp. So yeah.
Now, you mentioned this to me with Riley Opelka. Mm-hmm. I remember being at the USTA and just thinking they need to get this guy to go forward more. Mm-hmm. My son Connor told me one time he didn't like to be hugged by Riley Opelka because he only came up to his rib cage. And Connor's, you know, I'm sure he's 6'1". The guy is a walking giant, but my son Connor played at Florida State before he transferred to Ohio State. And the best player in college, as far as pro ranking, was one of his teammates. He was a senior. So when Connor was a freshman, JY. But you mentioned JY. Right. Then yeah. I got online.
Well, I saw him with Opelka. They came on the practice court together.
So I didn't really spend much time with JY, even though I've met him when he was a senior. My son was a freshman. But I do remember being in a match. It was Florida State versus Miami. The doubles is over. And JY, as the captain, spoke to the team. And I mean, he's obviously a pretty young guy, 22 mm-hmm. years old, but just the way he spoke was so impressive. But you said that he has a website. I looked it up. And that you followed that. You've listened to him.
Yeah, I listened to some of his stuff. I've watched, you know, followed him on Instagram. I first heard of him on the Parenting Aces podcast by, I believe it's Lisa Stone.
Lisa Stone, right?
Yeah, she had him on as a guest. I think she's had him on twice. I listened to one of the earlier interviews that she did with him and just kind of, you know, researched him a bit after that and followed some of his content. So I recognized him when he came on with the Opelka on the court.
With YouTube, this takes me back maybe to the 12s and 14s, but Tyler Trombetta, there's a match on YouTube between J-Way Abone mm-hmm. and Tyler Trombetta. But he's, for our listeners, he's been a coach, first did it privately, then with the USTA of mm-hmm. Riley Opelka. With other names here, sitting in the bleachers, and I saw the face looked so familiar. And, you know, that's, again, back to bleacher talk, is probably the highest ranked player in the building, you know, not currently, but past, was Kathleen Horvath, who was watching tennis. Her son's connected to the University of Virginia team. He's on the team. And she's best known for besides being in the top 10, this is hard to believe, but Navratilova lost one match in, I'm not sure, I guess 1983, but it was to Kathy Horvath. Yeah. Is that, so it's, here's one thing I mentioned, Ryan Harrison, with UTR, so many injuries, and I don't really follow pro tennis results, but he's obviously been playing enough where he's a 14.07 on the UTR. With John Patrick Smith, and my son Connor played him one time and was fortunate enough to win. Smith plays Smith. You could bet on Smith.
Smith versus Smith.
But like Sangren, he's a he's an Aussie, not like Sanger, but he's a University of Tennessee alum. He's hanging in there, 14.33 in doubles, born in 89, 1.7 million. That's a pretty good tennis player. I think just looking through this, how many people have you coached that have earned $1 million? At one time, Jimmy Connors with the Nuveen Tour, they didn't want to have the tournament be open, and they tried it one time and they dropped it to have a qualifier. Mm-hmm. And the unfortunate way to say is that no names. People didn't really make a mark in pro tennis, may not have even played pro tennis, but really stayed fit and kept working at their game, But what they set up for criteria, people running the events, is that you had to earn at least $1 million playing tennis to be in the $1 million club. And of course, if you look back, I always think of a guy by the name of Wayne Levy. Wayne Levy, a golfer from Herkimer, New York. And, told the story many times. My brother Pat was a really good golfer. And they were college teammates. And Wayne Levy, he, no lessons. He, one of the guys who went to the school and hit plastic golf balls around. And at one time, he was a top 50 money winner.
Okay.
And I can remember the same college I played hockey where he played golf, and we'd be getting off the bus, coming back from like Kingston, Ontario, wherever. Wayne is going to be in the building because behind the hockey rink, there's a patch of AstroTurf.
Right.
And he had a key and it could have been midnight and that guy is in there hitting golf balls. But John Patrick Smith is 108 in doubles. I don't think he's playing singles. He's at 531. But born in 1989, he's this passionate guy. He's just hanging in there. It's like I think that's one thing is that they just don't go away. George Goldoff, we mentioned, played against the teams that he lost to first round in Charlottesville. Then he went to Calgary, lost in the second round.
That's right.
But each time, lost to the winning team of the tournament. Mm-hmm. So he played against Patrick and Sam Verbeek, who 14.06 in doubles. In the doubles guys, it makes it really tough to win money. I'm not sure how it works at the challenger level, but the ATP level, it used to be, maybe it still is, 20% of the money goes to doubles, and you got to split that with he was a Virginia player in a tournament. I take a shot at pronouncing. What do you think? You take a shot at this right here. I put the pressure on you.
Which one?
Tyson.
Tyson Kwiatkowski.
Okay.
Wild card entry in Charlottesville. I have him on the draw sheet here.
But born in 1995, still at it, 181 in singles.
I believe he
also, that's a high.
I believe he also played on the school team as well. On the
sure. Yeah, that's where you're revered. All you have to do is, they have some amazing hardware. Think about what they've won.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back when we entered the facility with all the plaques and the names and the title winnings. I mean, Virginia went back-to-back NCAAs last year and the year before.
The USTA one time, governing body of tennis, had a meeting that there was going to be no more pro tournaments on college campuses.
Okay.
So the committee, that's what they get together and they finalize. because it's not fair, because how many, there's only so many weeks in the year, and there's so many universities. There's almost 5,000 colleges in the U.S. So the rule is, okay, no more pro tournaments on college tournaments that are college campuses.
College campuses.
Yeah, help me out. So anyway, someone said, what about Kalamazoo?
Right.
No more major events. Well, the National 18s, National 16s considered a major event. So there's such great tradition with Kalamazoo. The committee said, okay, got to reconvene and we'll change the rule back. Mm-hmm. But it's a great recruiting tool for the universities to have a tournament on site. But now what some of the universities are going to do is they're going to look at the sponsors instead of having a tournament on site. They're going to have that money go for NIL, name, image, and licensing.
Okay.
So those tournaments are in jeopardy because, you know, everything's subject to change. Here's a person to talk about. Tennis Sangren, the guy would have made a great hockey player. I understand Rob Krytek told me he's getting married, and I believe Austin is, I don't know if he's best man, but
he's up there.
I'd say he's in the wedding. He's big buddies with Sangren.
Okay.
14.34, doubles is a 13.9. Highest ranking, 41. When he tells his grandchildren, he hit
top 50.
Playing Federer, had 7 match points. Uh-huh. This is an excellent tennis player, $3.5 million. When you think about what's paid. What's paid to in the lower level tournaments. What else you got here? Anything else going on? I want to go through the story for motivating tennis players, educating tennis players. Did some research for this. You can jump in here. But you want me to go on this
yeah.
next
yeah.
piece?
Yeah, go ahead.
Player playing at Virginia now, James Hopper. So UTR singles is a 12.48. UTR doubles is a 12.45. Great tennis name, though, huh? Your name is Hopper. Go get the ball, Hopper.
Go get the balls, put them in the Hopper.
Here you go. With... So our network of coaches, not only here in the U.S., but around the world. Also, it's a young men that we've worked with that are very good tennis players. And they have this fantasy. It's almost like all they can do is chant D1, D1, D1. Mm-hmm. And they want to go to a brand school, want to go to a Power 5 conference. So this young man, again, great story. Grade 9, he's cut from his high school team. He ends up going to Case Western Reserve. I think at Case Western Reserve, I had one student years ago who went there. She's a doctor now, Polish immigrant, the family. Learned from the father. The father said, I want my daughter. She's been in tennis a long time. You know, and she's obviously not going to be a professional. She's not setting the world on fire, but she's good enough to go play Division III college tennis. But I want her to become a certified teaching pro.
Okay.
And I helped her with, I can't remember, the PTR, the USPTA. I've been a member of both those organizations for 40 years. Was a tester with both. And the term he uses, milestone.
Okay.
And it has just made an impact on me. That is all the years that kids put in the game, they should become, according to this gentleman, become a certified tennis teacher. Even if they never teach, they should be a licensed teaching professional. They have the experience to give back.
Through their playing and through their achievements.
Yeah, through their time in tennis. And but that's when I think of Case Western Reserve. But coming back to Hopper, he goes Division III. On his bio here, 2022-2023 NCAA doubles champion. 2023 team champion. Senior year ITA, Intercollegiate Tennis Association. For our listeners, 8-time All-American. So you only have a crack at being an 8-time All-American. You know, your freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, singles and doubles. Based on the pandemic, and I could be wrong, but this is just in reading about him. He's playing at Virginia now. He's on a scholarship. That's big time. I mean, they're the national champions. And I was told, I watched him play in the tournament we were at, play doubles with, he's a graduate student, so he's labeled GS.
Okay.
And so he still has eligibility. So the listeners, a lot of these kids who have dual credit or taking AP courses, there's lots of ways to stay connected with the college game. I mean, I talk to people sometimes, okay, let's go through this now, boom, 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 boom. You know, depending on, say, any example, but kids a junior in high school. Well, you got your junior year, your senior year. And you have, say, 5 years. You know, you're looking, and you got 7 years from now, you could still be working on winning matches for the school you represent. This fall, he has 2 top 10 wins, Division I players. He got to the quarters playing singles of the regionals. Actually, he lost to Jeffrey Von Meer Schnullenberg. I worked with his brother a little bit more, who plays at Harvard, but not enough to say that, okay, I was the coach. But his brother was sent to me when he was a young kid here in the States, and later, it's an American family that lives in Switzerland. But I remember meeting Jeffrey, and he just had the it thing, confident, come up to you, shake hands, smile on his face. But he's been in the lineup. He's a senior now. Time flies. So anyway, that's who he played. He lost to one of his teammates.
Right, right.
Wojo, I talked to Jeremy Wurtson about, I've talked to Tyler, or excuse me, the West, Case Western Reserve coach once on the phone. I have taught tennis. One time I did a workshop at the Cleveland Racquet Club where this team trains. They play every morning. That's when they practice.
Wow.
Wojciechowski, Todd Wojciechowski. They call him Wojo. Todd Wojciechowski. Apologize for mispronouncing your name, sir. But he played under Ty Tucker. Before they won the team title, they were runner-ups twice with I'll just go Wojo, Jeremy referred to him as. Started as the head coach at age 25. He was, after leaving Ty's program, an assistant at Citadel military school. So you think, well, that must have added up. Both the coach and the player are late starters to the game. You know, gathered from what I read, they're not country club kids. Son of immigrants. The coach, his father, the grandfather was a prisoner of war. He just, you know, so obviously they have a championship culture. Where do all the things add up to create that? But I read where Hopper and his teammates, they rented an apartment where it was right by a track.
Okay.
You know, so they could do, you know, what do you do on a track if you're an athlete? And the purpose of extra practice, extra training. They train first thing in the morning. Obviously, the weather in Ohio is not so good, but this Cleveland Racquet Club is a beautiful place. I've only been there in the winter, but it's a really, really nice club. The young kids that play at Case Western, when they do summer internships, same thing, is that they work out before they go to the office. They keep it going this summer. I do think that's true with a lot of Division III players, is they shut it down in the summer.
Okay.
And they don't keep it going year round. But Hopper was, you know, born in England, but he came to the Princeton area. He was coached by Glenn Michibata, Canadian, who was a great tennis player. You know, he's recruited by Ivy League schools, but he chose Case Western. Ivy League schools have no athletic scholarship. I would guess that he was offered scholarships. So I didn't read that, but I'm just guessing. But his coach tells the story, his college coach, Wojo, Case Western, where he gets up at 3 a.m. and he drives to watch him play. I think it was a high school match. The coach tells a story about talking to Dave Fish from Harvard. How do we become successful? How do you get to a place like Harvard is what Wojo, the Case Western coach, asked Fish, and Fish said, you put your bags down, and make where you are your own Harvard. Thought that was cool. The Case Western coach said their practice, it sounds like he definitely has an influence from Ty Tucker, where it's based totally on competition. Losers run, hungry. Keep the players hungry. And 14 of 18 of the players, Case Western won recent year. Not sure if it was the year they won the team title, but from first-generation families. It's amazing how many great tennis players are. Families of immigrants, where they see their parents learn a new language, learn a new way in a new country. Hopper was born, as I said, born in London. He used to play soccer. His coach also played soccer, so dual sport athletes. But, you know, why to mention Hopper is we have so many young players. Many times a kid will be so excited to practice with a better player. Mm-hmm. I've seen that. I've lived in Tampa for 15 years and spent a lot of time at Saddlebrook. And young players are so happy to go out and practice. At one time it was on the men's side. Maybe he didn't act that way, but the alpha dog would have been Sampras because he was based there. Or one time it was Isner. On the women's side, I think when Martina Hingis was there. Or Justine Henin.
Right.
Beautiful place, great fitness. You can't argue with the sunshine. They have hard and clay. But a junior gets a chance to practice there, and it's just cannon fodder. You know, the practice is not designed for the player, but they just love being able to hit with a pro. And there's positives to that. You know, I think parents many times always hope their child can hit with better players.
Right.
And there is that one side. If you're hitting with better players, the ball's coming deeper. It's coming faster. The consistency, the frequency is higher. So it helps people shorten up their swings by playing against better players. But if you play out the scenario, and now with the portal, Coach Deion Sanders, who's at Colorado.
Right. Coach Prime.
Yeah, prime time football.
Yeah, prime time.
He says he's not even looking at high school players. He's just going to the portal. So I've asked a couple of tennis coaches, are you doing the same thing? Or are you going to the portal? Yeah, we'll go there first.
Okay.
And I think that's I would not vote for the portal. A kid, you know, he gets reprimanded, chewed out, scolded, whatever by the coach. And then emotionally, they're ready to pack it in. And then once they put their name on the portal, everybody knows that they're available. Mm-hmm. And but with that, many times kids don't realize, okay, you go and you don't play as a freshman. And one overwhelming stat is 85% of people who don't play as a freshman don't make the lineup. But Vic Braden, go where you wanted. And but, you know, here's this young man. He's, you know, I think they're in position to be winning another title this year. And again, it was bleacher talk at a tournament, but, you know, I was told that, you know, he's definitely going to be in the lineup. You know, that's obviously an opinion. Only the head coach would know that, but he's going to be in the lineup for Virginia in doubles, and he's got a chance to play for him in singles. Certainly it's situational. Because of the pandemic, where he has this extra time. But you can always transfer. I tell kids, why don't you just go D3, play, and then if you're setting the world on fire, it's the same thing as playing up. So many kids play up, and they shouldn't play up. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Connors, arguably from the best age group ever in American tennis, said never play up. Always play where the pressure is. But if you're dominating, you know, okay, perhaps then you can move up. Okay. I remember Tracy Austin, who's taught by Vic Braden. She, Junior Whiteman Cup. I think it was Junior Whiteman Cup, English versus the English players playing the American players. She's already top 10 in the world, and she's trying out for the Junior Whiteman Cup. Mm-hmm. She made the team, but it was a big deal, okay, to step down, but to go backwards. And not always play up. But anyway, to just go spend some time talking about James Hopper, that don't turn your nose up at D3 tennis, especially if you haven't even seen D3 tennis play.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned that The Ivy League schools, they don't offer any sort of scholarships. That applies to tennis players, that applies to the athletics kind of side of things. Help me understand just, you know, what are the scholarship breakdowns between D2, D3, D1? How does that all play out?
Again, I'm not an expert. I mean, I talked to David Goetz today, who he's retired. He was most recently the coach at Penn. Mm-hmm. He told me that at Penn, basically, the rule of thumb is kids are paying 10% of their parents, their combined incomes.
Okay.
So for the sake of simple math, say both parents combined are making $100,000, the kid's going to pay $10,000.
Okay.
Every school is different. The times change. You know, at Harvard, every kid used to have to take a loan. And then when they left, they had to pay a loan. They had to take a loan. And I was told one of the reasons they did that is that it was a way to stay in touch with the graduates, because a lot of times a student will graduate and they don't really stay in touch with the school. Okay. Or they're not an active participant with the alumni. The women have 8 full scholarships, Division I.
Okay.
4.5 for the men.
Okay.
That's because of Title IX, gender equity, equal number of scholarships, mm-hmm. football teams, maybe I guess would be 95 players.
Okay.
So that's where like the non-revenue sports, wrestling. A lot of wrestling teams were dropped. Mm-hmm. Schools will have women's cross country, but they won't have men's cross country. They'll have women's golf and not have men's golf, or they have more scholarships for softball than they do for baseball.
Got it.
President Bush, number two, was going to table that right before 9/11. I remember a talk show, Phil Donahue, that no one's saying the art department has to be 50-50. Mm-hmm. It was so unfair for women for so long, but college athletic budgets are, for the most part, they're unfair for the men participating in, you know, non-revenue sports. Okay. So they don't generate a profit. Very few sports do. I mean, football for sure does. That's the big difference between, you know, say a D1 and a D2, or even you have the major D1 schools. There's all sorts of D1 schools that don't have big-time football. If you have big-time football, you have big-time money.
Yeah.
The Ivies, yeah, they don't have scholarships. Division III, there's academic aid, financial aid. Almost every school in the United States is blind admissions. You get in, mm-hmm. then they determine what you can pay.
Okay.
Almost no one pays sticker price. Mm-hmm. It is true, though, that the parents that, you have to, for financial aid, submit financial records. So if parents have invested and they have income property and such, it's what they've done in the stock market, whatever their holdings are, whatever their estate is, it turns into a puzzle on whether your child's going to get financial aid or not. But there's a human element to it as well.
Right.
Many of these coaches, not to say it's political, but if someone has worked at a school for 20 years and they know the financial officer, ever running, financial aid, the admissions office. What else on players? It's just to go through different stories. Tennis Sangren, I remember being with him. I never coached him for a second, but I traveled with Austin Krajicek, who was playing doubles with Sangren. I remember telling Sangren he was doing really well in these challengers. And I said, "You've done so well since you met me." And I looked at me and said, "Yeah, I mean, I'm the reason you played so well." I've actually watched him play in juniors for a long time with, he stayed with some friends of mine up in Toronto, and he's got a big fan and a big fan base in Toronto. But I remember him playing Jack Sock in a challenger, Champaign, Illinois. And I said, "You played so well when Jack Sock was tanking." And I remember he said, he goes, "Oh, thanks," but he goes, he plays the same way, no matter whether he's tanking or he's competing, he plays the same way. And it's so true. I remember he was playing Stevie Johnson one time, and I said, "Oh, tell me what your plans are." You know, at that time, he goes, well, I've played him twice. I beat him both times. He said, I'm going to go 2 to the forehand and 1 to the backhand. 2 to the forehand. But it was best of 5. Mm-hmm. And Austin had lost, so we had driven back to Florida, which is not that far from Atlanta to Tampa. And so I watched the match online. And tennis really had him beat. Best of 5, he just couldn't close. So Stevie Johnson got a little better on the backhand side. And with that, that hasn't been Sangren's forte, is volleying. I was at the U.S. Open one time and was with Arvind Don and Ron Ramanathan, and we're sharing a court. And who we were sharing a court with? Austin Krajicek and Tennis Sangren. Mm-hmm. And Sangren had just beaten my son convincingly in a tournament. So I went up to him and said, Sangren, what are you doing beating my kid? And he goes, I just treated. He goes, I played so well. He's being a nice guy. So here he is, you know, he's in the qualies of the U.S. Open and ranked 41. Certainly he's been main draw.
Right.
But he said to me, he goes, I should have worked on my volleys. He left his car at our place when he had hip surgery. And I would never do this, but I did because it was a circumstantial. I said, hey, you have an operation on your hips or your hip. When you come back to get your car, pro bono, I'll help you with your volleys. So here he is at the U.S. Open, and he just says to me, he's such an honest guy. He just says, I should have worked on my volleys.
I should.
And, but you know, he did well with Austin. You know, he was serving. He was definitely one up, one back. But again, going back straight across the board, going into the Charlottesville Challenger, great respect for the players there. Mm-hmm. They're warriors. Most of them, I would say, physical specimens. Andre Barbosa came back, and he's right with Raven Glasson, who's not the tallest guy. He was saying that Raven wasn't 100% accurate when he's talking about how big the players are. Because then Andres was throwing some numbers at me where, you know, that's you just want to be fact-based, is it not just throw up opinions and go with hearsay. But, you know, we saw all sorts of players that had all sorts of problems, but they were still competing.
Yeah.
And they've been at it a long time.
They're athletes.
But again, one day, I mean, I've been going to tournaments all levels for a long, long time. And it's always easy to second guess. It's always easy to be the armchair quarterback. But say with Kudla, and who's, you know, $4.5 million, on his worst day, I don't think 7% net appearances on an indoor hard court. And especially the way Patrick Gibson was serving. And the one thing with Patrick, he won 100%. He won every time he came to the net, he won the point.
Yeah.
And the idea of being managed by stats. Wayne Gretzky is pretty well-known quote in the hockey world right now. He says, stats are for losers. You know, it's like, you know, how the story goes, they're talking about goalies and the save percentage. And Gretzky said, stats are for losers. I just want to know how many Stanley Cups did that goalie win, that type of thing. And it's not so much the save percentage. But pro tennis, Tracy Austin. I tell the people I train, tennis coaches, when you hear something that you like, make it a story. And I heard Tracy Austin say, and I'm sure she heard it, you know, the family she's from, 5 children, 4 of them played pro tennis, is that you don't find pro tennis finds you. Mm-hmm. And then talking about James Hopper, who went, you know, you listen to his coach talk about him, and that's an amazing thing about YouTube. You can listen to these interviews and what Hopper did for the program, and you know, to get up every day and compete for a national championship with a team and win a national championship. And it's an amazing story. It's very much the same way. Big time college tennis will find you. You won't find big time college tennis. Yeah. I know a lot of people and tennis parents, Steve, can you write this coach? Can you call this coach? And I go, yeah, I can. The juniors coming up, they should really take care of their academics. It's in your favor to have the highest GPA possible, the highest SAT score possible. You got to know the rules. Can you find a way to take a gap year, take a redshirt year, to take more time. You know, what do you do in your summers? But I think to go and not play matches, you know, especially the boys, I think the boys, a lot of times they don't realize that there's three college coaches on the team. Mm-hmm. And when the team travels, all three coaches go.
Right.
So say, for example, they only travel with eight. Maybe they're carrying 12 players on the team. 9, 10, 11, 12. Now the programs with bigger budgets will take everyone.
Right.
But my experience, the team goes off to spring break. And the kid doesn't go. And they go to the bar. You know, misery enjoys company, and then they complain and they start partying and maybe I've told this story in the podcast, a Ryler DeHart story. Ryler DeHart, known him a long time. He was coached first by Tomas Olofsted. Tomas was in our Tennis Tech program, a Swedish player, great guy. And he brought me into the loop right away. So I was a video coach. And then I relocated to Tampa, so I started coaching Ryler at a very young age, I think sixth grade, definitely seventh grade. And I coached him all through high school. So then he goes to college and he plays for Craig Tiley, who was also in the Tennis Tech program. He's a classmate of Tomas Olofsted. Oh, there's always a little white lie. I think almost everybody is guilty of those little white lies. So Debbie DeHart, late Debbie DeHart, became very good friends with her. She did such a great job, single mom, bringing up Ryler. So they tell me they can't go to practice. So then I end up after school at a facility right up the road to pick up trophies. Mm-hmm. So we had some Japanese kids visiting. And when a Japanese kid visits and they get a trophy, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. I've been in Japan for presentations. If a kid plays on Saturday and the trophy presentation's on Sunday, they're done. They're part of the draw is done. They're getting their trophy on Sunday. They stay overnight in a hotel and they go to the trophy presentation. So I'm scrambling around. You know, they didn't have the trophies. They weren't ready when the tournament was over. So I'm running errands. I have a couple people ready to run practice. And the way we run practice is we could have our students run practice. So I show up and, you know, Debbie had said Ryler couldn't practice. So I show up and he's right on the center court. Mm-hmm. And he's practicing with a player who was quite good in Florida. He's definitely top five. He had gone to Notre Dame. So when Ryler was going to be a freshman at this school my son went to as well, Jesuit, the other boy is going to be a freshman at Notre Dame. And so I show up and they're just guilty, nowhere to hide. And I said, well, you know, that young kid, he's got some holes in his game. And, you know, Ryler does this, and this is that you shouldn't be in awe of this player and drop everything because he can hit with a better player. Just like the, you know, be cannon fodder, always get the chance to go practice with the pros or go to a Division I school. And you're not in contention to be in the lineup. It's just your ego that wants you to go there.
Right.
So when this young man goes off to Notre Dame and it's his freshman year, instead of practicing with, or excuse me, instead of traveling with the team, he's sent to Tampa to work with me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Ryan were to hear this podcast, that's a story where, you know, why did Debbie DeHart from that point forward go, I'm going to have my son listen to this guy. I can remember, you know, my son Mikhail is a lefty. And like a couple of the post videos we made just this past weekend, a young girl from New Jersey, girl from Connecticut. So here's my son who's maybe 11 years old at the time. He's in front of this kid who's at Notre Dame, who Ryler, his mother said, well, hitting with this kid will be better than going to Steve's practice. And so all of a sudden she goes, okay, I'm a believer now. It's really interesting, you know, the idea that I'll believe it when I see it. I like to turn around. I'll see it when I believe it. So Anyway, watching pros, thank you again for these players hanging in there. They're not making that much money and they're not playing pickleball. I'm all for pickleball, but we have to fight and carry the flag for tennis. Anyone who's connected to pickleball, there is a ready position. There is a unit turn. Play with your larger body parts. Address that sport where some people will be negative and say it's not a sport. Well, when you watch really good world-class tennis players or even, you know, former college players play pickleball, it becomes a sport.
Yeah, for sure.
It becomes a sport.
I mean, just watching some of those matches from Brookhaven on Tennis Channel this week, like you mentioned, you know, some of the men's matches and some of the higher level competitive women's matches, it's definitely a different game. They hit fast, they hit hard, they run side to side, back and front. So the skills are very much transferable. Just,
oh, and there's positives. You know, they have to have great touch, yeah, and, you know, with the way the game is played, the kitchen and such. But with, you know, it is activity. It is fitness. So it's very good for older people. But that expression, if you can't beat them, join them. And I don't think pickleball is taking the same path as racquetball. I don't see it fading away because Chuck Gill told me years ago that, and he's been a president of the USPTA, and I know he's a leader in the Florida Tennis Association, and I believe he's been very active with the USTA. I remember him just talking to him for a minute at the US Open, and he said, this is years ago, he says it's a casual sport. I wish they would just leave it alone, let it be a casual sport. Because right. At one time, tennis was that way. You could just go to the park and everybody was playing. In some ways, tennis has become too structured. The NTRP,
right.
A lot of positives, especially those people that are, you know, I have friends who own indoor tennis clubs. The NTRP has been great. Okay, there's a 3-0 league. There's a 3-5 league. There's lots of teams, and they're, you know, renting court time for matches, renting court time for practices. But the flip side of that is the NTRP. Now we don't really have juniors. They're playing veterans. We have a visitor here who is 34 years old, rebuilding his game. And I said, next year you'll be a junior vet, meaning you'll be 35. That used to be a trick question on the USPTA test. You had to put together a draw sheet, and JV doesn't mean junior varsity. It meant junior vet. And, you know, if someone was, you know, just putting the seeds together for an open tournament. Yeah, sometimes things can be too structured, and that's what I guess I could end by saying this: with great base tennis education and asking people to help us out a little bit, we're just carrying the torch for tennis teachers from the past. Again, Chuck Tomlin, who I played just a minute of what he had to say a couple times. I think the tennis teachers of the past, there's so much that, you know, we need to keep the torch, keep the light on what people from like a Vic Braden has done in the past. And Dave Danerson, it's been mentioned many times. I think what he said, a theme for tennis is back to the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the challenger at Charlottesville, we were only there blink of an eye.
Yeah.
But so we can't say, oh, just from that one day. But are people playing all over the court? Are they serving and volleying? Are there lost arts? And I think that comes back to pickleball, is that it's so easy. And I think also too, is that we make big mistakes as teachers or leaders in tennis, that we're having kids compete too early, get kids to play other sports, have them be playing multiple number of sports when they're younger, know the history of the game. And I think that is something that helped Roger Federer, because he was connected to Peter Carter first and Tony Roach. He has an Australian tennis background. And the Australians, how it was a countryfied sport in all the small towns across Australia years ago, everybody was playing doubles. There's so many kids playing. Doubles was a priority, and people knew how the best players in the world played. who knows? Maybe there's a positive in pickleball because people in pickleball are going forward more than they are in singles.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
And then in tennis. Yeah.
They're going forward more in pickleball than they are in tennis for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
No.
The young man from Toronto, the Toronto Maple Leafs. Shout out to them.
Shout out to the Leafs. Did come through last night against Vancouver Canucks. That was always good to see. The night before, an OT, a shootout win against the Flames. That boy.
I have you scheduled to take a gift to a young person in Toronto. I missed a great party, a wedding earlier in the summer, but if the Stanley Cup goes to Toronto, I think that's where okay. Because we had scheduled, some people were scheduled to come here. I thought I had the weekend free and didn't have the weekend free, but anyway, if the Maple Leafs win the Stanley Cup, that's a place to go.
Go Leafs, go.
Go Leafs, go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think our boy Richard Hernandez has been a guest a couple of times, been a resident in Toronto a long time. I think he says when the superstars all are about 28, I think they're roughly 26, 27, they're a year or two away from what he predicts to be when they put it together.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Go Leafs, go. Thanks for listening. I hope you got a golden nugget or two from this. It was a great day, field trip, going to a pro event. Adios, amigos. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks for listening.